Hi everyone, welcome to the third series of the Race and Health podcast. We're partnering with the Lancet Voice podcast to discuss issues raised in the recent Lancet series on racism, xenophobia, discrimination and health, published in December 2022. My name is Dylan Devakumar. I'm a professor of global child health in University College London and was the lead on the academic series. Today's episode is on epistemic injustice, which we touched on in the first paper. How do we know what we know, whose voice is heard and whose isn't, and what are the implications of this? Who gets to decide? These are the kinds of questions that I'll be talking about with my three guests today. We have Dr. Tarusha Naidu, who's an associate professor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal and a clinical psychologist practicing in public health in South Africa. Her research focuses on equity in global medical education and global health, inspired by her experiences as a Global South researcher in global health, mental health, and infectious diseases. Tarusha is interested in how research, authorship, and scholarship practice shape dominant and marginalized narratives. Next is Dr. Rageshri Dharawan, who's a sexual health and HIV doctor and researcher based at Barts Health NHS Trust and Queen Mary University of London. Her clinical practice, research, and advocacy focus on inequalities, particularly at the intersection of gender and race or ethnicity. She's an inaugural Welcome Collection and Spread the Word awardee. She's writing a book on how people go unheard in healthcare and what can be done to address this. And finally, we have Dr. Shay Abimbola, who's a health systems researcher from Nigeria, who's currently based at the University of Sydney, where he's an associate professor and principal research fellow. His teaching and research is on knowledge practices in global health, health system governance, and the adoption and scale-up of health system innovation. Shay was awarded the Prince Claus Chair in Equity and Development at Utrecht University and is also the Editor-in-Chief of BMJ Global Health. Thank you all for joining me. So, traditionally, minoritized groups have been excluded from research and knowledge production, and this has led to some of the racial inequities where we don't know what the issues are and the potential solutions to those issues, and this idea of epistemic injustice. Rageshri, can I come to you first? Can you tell us what epistemic injustice is and why it's important?
So epistemic injustice as a term was first coined by the British philosopher Miranda Fricker back in 2007 in her book Epistemic Injustice, Power and Ethics of Knowing. And she basically described this as a wrong occurring to someone in their capacity as a knower. So being able to produce knowledge and to pass it on to each other is a basic human ability. And if you can't do that for various reasons, you experience an injustice and we find ourselves losing a bit of our humanity. So it really strikes deep into heart of what makes us human. And she said that this is really a type of injustice that sits alongside other forms of social injustice. So minoritized groups who may face other forms of social injustice often experience epistemic injustice. And she came up with two different types, although that has now been expanded by other philosophers to include other concepts. But I can briefly talk you through the main two that she described. So the first one is testimonial injustice, which occurs when a person's voice or knowledge is discounted or dismissed due to prejudice from the listener about their social identity. So essentially, a speaker is seen as not being credible when they speak. They experience a credibility deficit or an excess, potentially, due to stereotypes around their social identity. So it's often associated with the speaker's gender, ethnicity, class, sexual orientation, ability, or religion. And an example that she gives in the book is about a woman going to the police to report that she's been sexually assaulted, but the police not believing her because they don't think that she is a credible witness. They don't believe her testimony. The other form that she describes is hermeneutical injustice, which occurs when the experiences of marginalized individuals or groups are not understood by themselves or by others because those experiences do not fit any concepts known to them or others. And again, in her book, if we think about sexual violence again, she gives the example of the concept of sexual harassment in the workplace. So this was discussed a lot in the 60s and 70s, but before then it wasn't really discussed as a term. So women who were experiencing it perhaps couldn't describe it to themselves, identify themselves as experiencing it, and then communicate that to others. So for me, I think epistemic injustice is really important because it can decide who is heard and listened to, who's believed, and also then who is silenced. So I think it has lots of implications for healthcare.
Thank you. Shay, if I could come to you, I know you've written on this topic and these ideas, testimonial and hermeneutical, and I think in your paper you describe it as interpretive. Can you talk about this framework and your thoughts on this, please?
Yes, thank you very much. I sort of swapped the term interpretive because it's just more intuitive and it's more sort of in prose, as it were, compared to hermeneutical. And in part because part of what I think of as epistemic injustice is the inability of people to actually share common concepts that they could then share their experience with. So the example of sexual harassment becomes really important here, that it was the framing, the language, the term that allows people to communicate, understand themselves, and be understood. So for me, it's important that one actually uses language. But sort of for me, the broader framing, one of the things that I took seriously is a certain sense in which Frika's framing is almost too individual. There's a sense in which it is injustice between people. And that is important. But in many instances, in many ways, the injustice is also caked in into the institutions that govern us, right? So, and the platforms we use. So we were talking about communication just now, that there are platforms for communication that exclude people, that even if you were, you know, you don't find yourself with a platform in the first place. And when you do, you are perhaps less believed. So there's something institutional about this injustice that I think deserves a lot. The third qualification that I would give that framework is also that identify two ways in which it manifests. So the credibility deficit that leads to testimonial injustice. I think of that in terms of credibility deficit because of one's positionality. But I also think of it perhaps also in addition, in terms of one's role as the audience of knowledge that is produced. So for example, when we think about whom do we defer to in how we articulate the knowledge, whose existing knowledge we are taking into account, whose learning needs we address ourselves to, whose preferences in society we align ourselves to. That too, for me, is a form of that kind of epistemic injustice in that who is a worthy audience? So in addition to the one's positionality, as it were, it's also one's role as being the receiver of the knowledge. And again, in my mind, I've always tried to make sure that I give enough attention to that role as audience. Again, knowledge platforms come into being, becomes really important here. So for example, if I do a piece of research and I only publish it in a particular place, I am implicitly saying that only those who can get to that place are the people worthy of the research that I've done.
Thank you. So this idea of, I guess it mirrors kind of racial hierarchies that exist. And there's hierarchies in kinds of knowledge and places that it's published in audiences that it's accessible to. And Tarisha, would you like to expand on this?
Yeah, I think it's a good jumping off point to start where Shea left off, which is to say that Fricker's work is really valuable, but it's quite Western in its orientation, in the sense that it implies, especially on the hermeneutical level, it implies a wider social context, but doesn't unpack that explicitly. It also doesn't unpack a historical context in terms of global dynamics around how people interact around race and the geopolitics of race and how it has been influenced by global history and what we're living with today. So I would want to extend the idea of epistemic injustice two steps kind of historically backward to look at systemic injustices and structural injustices at the sort of recent past level from the Black Lives Matter and what we'd be talking about there, but also to go further back to what the decolonial scholars and critical scholars talk about when they talk about knowledge production as it's been happening and how those structures of knowledge and epistemology have been built over generations so that we unconsciously talk, think, write, and build knowledge in ways that represent, replicate, and recreate those epistemic systems that are the platforms, that provide the platforms, that are the audiences. So even us that are fighting against it inadvertently fall into being audience and speaker. So I would want to look back. I mean, there's a great paper by Emily Besson in BMJ Global Health around epistemic injustice. And her work takes it one step further, looking at coloniality of knowledge and knowledge production, which is the background story of hermeneutic injustice. And we're inadvertently colluding with it, even those of us that push back against it. Kind of the structural, systemic knowledge, but also really become aware of the historical antecedents that created that hermeneutical system.
Brilliant. Thank you to all of you. So can I just push a little bit further on what kinds of knowledge are being excluded? What kinds of data are being excluded? And who exactly is being excluded from these conversations?
I can say something about that because I had a conversation based on some research that I'm currently doing, and it's research on women's health issues in a neighboring African country. And it's interesting when there is cross-national or global health research, how people come in from a different context with different epistemic frameworks and asked the wrong kinds of questions because they want to set up for the kind of data that they're collecting. But they don't have the frameworks to listen for the kind of data that people want to give and that are relevant. So your question around what types of knowledge and who is being excluded are one and the same thing, because how we speak our experience in the world is directly related and inextricable from who we are, which is why positionality and the whole move towards positionality in research is being foregrounded. So for instance, I'll answer by telling you about some of the work that I'm trying to do with the research that I'm doing with women and health issues in Africa and trying to flip the audience, flip the narrative, flip the method on allowing people or encouraging people to give data or to offer data in completely different ways. So if people need to present their experience through song, through poetry, entering a space and structuring an interview or collecting data in ways that make sense to us, we let go of our need to, as researchers or people from positions of power, colonized people, to control the space and elicit the kind of data we want to elicit.
Can I jump in there? That if you read the pages of The Lancet, you would hardly see any research paper that is a qualitative research paper. They don't publish it because they've assumed for some reason that it is inferior, or that, you know, someone doesn't think it is inferior. Someone in their audience doesn't think it is worthy, credible. And a lot of the knowledges that you get from struggle and from people on the margins present themselves in that particular way, such that by that singular decision of an elite journal, we exclude the voices of many, many, many people whom the journal would otherwise claim it's trying to serve. And I'm going to do the flip side of that, that a lot of the research papers will be papers that are randomized controlled trials, which make a lot of sense for clinical questions about simple direct interventions, and make much less sense, perhaps even completely epistemically wrong and unjust, for more complex things about which the people you're interacting with, the people you're intervening upon, whose, you know, et cetera, that you are working with, will know far more than to reduce a question to something that could be answered in that basic yes or no way. And very often, we gravitate towards those kinds of methods, in part because journals love the kind of answers that they present, but also in part because the audience of the research that we do, it's not those people, it's some other people elsewhere who want to imagine the world as far more simple than it really is. And again, by doing that, we exclude the knowledge of many people, again, primarily people on the margins, because those people who we're trying to serve as audience will tend to be powerful, privileged people at the center. So there are different ways in which knowledge platforms work that, by definition, serve to exclude.
And can I just come in there? So I think particularly clinicians, we really like certainty. And a lot of, you know, randomized controlled trials can sometimes give us that evidence that we can come up with more certain answers. And that is obviously important in things like evidence-based medicine, which has been the main paradigm for kind of the last 30 years in terms of medicine. And as Shay said, obviously RCTs are great for some questions, but not good for other questions. And sometimes we just don't have the evidence to be able to answer what we should do with the patient in front of us. And we don't like that, which is why other forms of research and knowledge are so important. I also just wanted to say, just in terms of things like journals, I'm guessing, you know, language is an issue. Most journals publish in English, for example, which may exclude some researchers and other forms of knowledge. And also, I guess, the question around fees. So if you want your paper to be open access, you have to pay a very large fee, which also can exclude researchers who may not be able to have the funds to do that.
And I suppose this goes a bit broader in that science generally is in English. I mean, that's changing with the rise of countries like China, for example, but it's broader than just publishing or just journals. Okay, so can we talk a little more about the health impact of epistemic injustice?
So I think it has a lot of impacts on health in terms of at the individual level and at the kind of more group systemic level as well. So if we take it right down to the consultation room, you've got the clinician and the patient. And we know that patients can often experience testimonial injustice. So they will tell their doctors what are going on, and their doctors may not feel that what they're saying is credible. So they may dismiss what they're saying. And I think a really good example of that when we talk about a specific condition is endometriosis. So the average time to diagnosis of this condition, which is a very common menstrual condition around the world, is that it takes about 8 years to diagnosis. And the reason for that is that people will often say they go to their doctors and they say, we have these very painful periods and other symptoms, and their doctors don't believe them. They say, you know, this is very normal. Perhaps these symptoms in your head, they may feel a bit gaslit. But either way, they feel rejected by their doctors. So they go back and forth and their diagnosis is delayed. And these kind of repeated incidences can put people off from going to their doctor. They may not trust that they will carry out what, you know, the investigations they need. So that can really lead to mistrust as well. So when doctors are kind of skeptical of their patient's testimony, it means that patients won't go back to them. So that kind of really individual level can lead to kind of late diagnosis and health impacts. And also important to think that epistemic injustice can affect patients because they are ill. So there are some philosophers who talk about how just having a long-term illness in itself can put you at risk of testimonial injustice and epistemic injustice, because you're not seen as being very capable. You're seen as being biased because you are ill. You can't be objective. So when we think about things like endometriosis, it's often women of colour who will say that they've been dismissed by their doctors. And more on a group level, it means that patients can't advocate for the condition they have. So we may see these conditions being less researched, less funding being put into policy, less attention, essentially. And this can lead to gaps in our collective scientific knowledge. So thinking particularly about women's health, for example, there are considerable gaps. If we take endometriosis, this is a condition that affects 1 in 10 people who menstruate around the world. We don't know what causes it. We don't really have any good treatments for it. So perhaps the fact that women over the years have been dismissed means there's been a lack of research, a lack of priority put into that. And when we think the research gender gap, we know that in the UK, a third of women experience a reproductive or gynecological problem in their lifetime, but less than 2.5% of public funds are available to research this field. So I think epistemic injustice has impacts specifically for the patient with their doctor. It causes silencing, but also for patient groups and whole disease areas.
So in the space of public policy or health policy, something that I spend all my time thinking about is how we decide on the interventions that we decide upon. Say a government or a multilateral agency like the World Bank decides that, for example, a country needed X intervention. And I give an example that I think about a lot. It's something called performance-based financing. And there was a version of it in the UK with Quality Outcomes Framework. But this is sort of this was at a bigger level, and especially in low and middle income countries with weak primary healthcare system, where the World Bank decides that what needed to be done to improve the quality of primary healthcare was to give performance incentive to health primary healthcare facilities, which on the surface of it would seem to make sense. But if they spoke to people who work in those primary healthcare facilities, perhaps the first thing they would hear is that the facilities don't have supplies in the first place, or the facilities they're not being paid their salary, or the road that leads to the facility just doesn't work enough for people to come there. So there are the ways in which we make assumptions, especially we, meaning people who are more powerful, when we decide what people who are much less powerful need, without actually asking them and without the willingness to listen and take on board what it is they have to say. Because sometimes we actually go and ask and pretend as if we haven't heard what was said to us. So there's just that example where public policies just fail to achieve their intended purpose, because the people who are supposed to be the recipients of those efforts have their knowledge has been discounted, their interpretation of their own reality. So there's just that simple, almost utilitarian argument as to, you know, if you have been epistemically unjust in public policy, you're actually not going to achieve the goals that you've set out to achieve. But for me, there's another example. I was speaking to a civic official, and I asked him, why aren't government funding primary healthcare and they're seeing universal health coverage? And he said to me that it's not good to ask people. They don't say they want primary health care or universal health coverage. They say they want good road networks. They say they want water supply. They say they want education for their children. Things that, to my own ears, sound like at the very heart of primary health care. This is primary health care they are telling you they want. There isn't commonly shared frameworks for interpreting priorities between a powerful government figure and people in the community.
Thank you. So that, in those two examples you describe, I suppose a rich country institution implementing interventions in low middle income countries, but then also that dynamic within a country where powerful institutions within a country are not listening to the, I guess, urban and rural communities in those countries. Tarisha.
Shay and Rageshri's both ends of the story make me think of the middle. I work in mental health in a very big public hospital in Durban, South Africa. It's the most poverty-stricken province in my country. And I see both ends, but in a bizarre middle phenomenon that happens where patients don't have a testimonial injustice benefit because the system doesn't hear them. But then even more so because they have mental illness, which is another stigma. There's also the public health level where patients are not heard and share side of the story. But there's a bizarre phenomenon where health professionals internalize the hermeneutics of the dominant system and try to hear what they should be hearing rather than what patients are telling them. I'm flabbergasted at how clinicians will keep on asking the questions that they've learned how to ask and that fit into the system, hoping that if they ask it in different ways or if they do it differently, the patient will tell them what they want to hear rather than what is really going on. And this actually is an injustice against the clinician as well. Being a woman of color clinician in a low middle income country, no one wants to hear your point of view and say, I know this patient, they're my neighbor, I can hear them. But it doesn't fit into the hermeneutic system of knowledge production, of structure, way in which the middle clinicians are replicating the system.
Minoritized clinicians will often find themselves not being heard, as you say, in your example. And I think that can really put them off from speaking up more. So they may feel, you know, underconfident, less able to apply for leadership positions, less likely to be on kind of decision-making boards. And something that I've thought about for a long time is, you know, this concept of imposter phenomenon, which everyone is now critiquing as they should do, because it is not the problem of the individual person. It is a societal problem of how they treat people. So if you repeatedly experience testimony injustice, for example, if you're not listened to, you may not think that you are a very good speaker. It might affect your confidence and your career down the line. So I think when minoritized clinicians are not heard, again, they can't advocate for their minoritized patients who may be from their community.
I think that's true in the global north and probably in countries like the UK and the US, where people of color are minoritized clinicians. That's not the case where I am. I'm not a minoritized clinician. Practically everybody looks like me. You know, everyone, I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find the white clinician in my hospital. But the phenomenon that I'm talking about is that we and my colleagues might internalize the voice of that epistemic injustice and speak and manage the environment as if we have the metaphorical, mythical white clinician on our shoulder and trying to replicate that imposter syndrome. So it's even more bizarre, I think, than what you're suggesting, where there's an external body and an external system imposing it on you.
So thank you. And I want to push the conversation forward to look at what we should do going forward. Tarisha.
I want to reflect on what Shay said earlier, and he specifically mentioned literature. And I think we really, around epistemic injustice, we have to look outside our frames of comfort when it comes to where we seek new ways of constructing knowledge and how we seek it. And I'll talk about my personal experience growing up in South Africa and the experience of how you learn what an audience is, how to think about what legitimate knowledge is. It was all colonial literature. And until I read Toni Morrison's Bluest Eye, and the whole book is about how you are not somebody because you don't look a certain way, that you don't exist as a person because your eyes are not blue. It's a very powerful book. And the work of people like Alice Walker, to hear a woman of color speak a story that I could identify with is a very powerful way of looking at it. And my point is that we need to look outside of academic literature. I've been tracking authors that are clinicians. And when we write in a creative nonfiction way and we speak our experiential truth, even if you're not a clinician, I'm thinking of Tsitsi Dabaremba's work, which from the moment I read it, Nervous Conditions, really stuck with me and spoke to me. So we have to encourage people to go to literature, to go to other forms of expression, because they connect our liminal experience of the world with our conscious cognitive experience and displace us into a different way of experiencing knowledge and knowledge production.
That's really fascinating. And I was just thinking what you were saying about the spoils bit, and that we haven't really talked much about people who've got credibility excess, so people who are just seen as being more trustworthy or knowledgeable than they really are. And again, at an individual level in healthcare, that can cause harm because these are the people who will always be believed by their doctors. They'll get unnecessary tests. Actually, all they may need is a bit of reassurance, but they may get, you know, unnecessary tests, which may cause them harm. But also when we think in terms of the research space, who gets the funding to do research, they may not be the right people. They will get the funding and perhaps the publications. I just wanted to talk a little bit about epistemic injustice and kind of clinical care. I think the training thing is really important. I think in medical curriculums, we are trained to not listen for lots of reasons. So we are inherently taught to be skeptical of our patients' testimonies. And that comes out in our language when we talk about patient complains, patient denies, patient alleges. This is routine in patient notes. The bit about art is really important. And there is an increasing movement to include more medical humanities and narrative medicine, or we think about medicine more as an art than a science, and how we need to have both to really understand the world and be more humble when it comes to when we think about medicine and patient care. And I think a lot of our training really looks at how clinicians see themselves. I think often we can see ourselves as being fixers. So, you know, we can diagnose a patient, we can fix them, we can use evidence-based medicine to make those decisions. But actually, a lot of what patients want is just to be heard and listened to and have their suffering validated. And even if we can't fix them, we need to acknowledge that actually part of our role is to be a witness and to validate their suffering. So I think that's something that's not really brought into medical education. And of course, we need listening environments. We need a government that listens, that will fund healthcare. We need hospitals and healthcare centres where we have the privacy and the time to really hear our patients.
So I'm currently doing a paper, a study, which is quite a big review. I'm trying to synthesise a lot of the discussion that has gone on the last sort of 5-6 years in global health literature around epistemology, around the knowledge practices of global health. And in doing that synthesis, which is a very difficult synthesis to do because it's all over the place, it's huge, I had to sort of distill the conditions that actually lead to a lot of epistemic injustice down to six. So the first one is the mislabeling of people as individuals or as groups, or mislabeling of issues, right? So this idea of imposter syndrome or race as an explanation for health outcomes, or in fact, some countries as low or middle-income countries, or some people as vulnerable. Think of vulnerable, you can flip it to vulnerabilized, for example, or minority as minoritized. And again, the weight of just flipping the language you use, how that we label phenomena, can reshape how we think about them in ways that allow us to see the world better and see people more clearly. The second category is what I call miseducation. But it's in many ways that a lot of the things we do, we've been educated to do, went to school to be taught how to be epistemically unjust in many ways, and we just carry on. And it's important that we go back and begin to try and see if we can address that. The third one is underrepresentation, which is much talked about. So it's the idea that the fewer of a certain kind of people you have in a space, the more likely it is that their views are misrepresented in the space, or not represented at all. The fourth one is under governance. In other words, there's this sense in which, linked to education, but slightly different, is the idea that we exist in epistemic spaces without rules to govern us for the most part. So that we default to the how the machine rules and we just run with it. And we need to begin to think about how we craft rules that constrain us to justice. The fifth one is tentatively called compounded spoils, which goes back to the idea that those who have more. So you've stolen wealth. The English colonized the world, and so the whole scientific establishment is now in English. And it continues to be so. That also means that those who were taken from continue to lose. So the more one spoil compounds, the more one's the other side's loss compounds. And again, to begin to think about how to address that in different ways becomes important. The final one is, and again, going back to the space of art, there's a song by the Nigerian Afrobeat artist Fela Kuti, which is called Kolo Mentality. And there's a line in it where he says, Kolo Mentality, them don't really see you, but you never really see yourself. So that's in Pidgin English. I'm going to say it in English now, which is they have released you, but you haven't released yourself. And he was talking about the post-colonial condition in Nigeria. That there were too many Nigerians who were singing in the 60s and 70s. There were too many Nigerians who still want to be British. And that you need to free yourself from that. And that's the final point here, that there is a sense in which one gets conditioned by one's colonizer or in different setups where you want to be like them instead of actually reclaiming who one is. So again, that reclamation process, which is tied to education, which is tied to labeling, all of these things are connected in many in deep ways. If I can, Delana, I wanted to ask Thirusha to talk a bit more about that, the ways in which existing cultural practices in many colonized settings or around care were destroyed in many ways by the colonial experience, by the imposition of Western medicine. And just thinking about what Ragesh was describing there, that there are other ways in many different cultures around care that in some places are completely lost, in some other places are struggling to remain vibrant.
So that's an interesting example, because I can talk about a specific example in psychiatry, because that's the environment that I work in. And when I started my training, as soon as somebody mentioned having gone to a traditional healer for mental health kind of problems, they would just be dismissed. It would be really derogatory words like witchcraft would be used, and clinicians who had been colonized, the way I see it, would not allow for the person to even talk about the experience in seeing traditional healers and going to their traditional doctors, and people were made to feel like they were even more mentally ill, and their whole system was criminalized, if you want to call it that, because even traditional doctors would not be legitimized in their system. More and more I'm seeing now that when patients appear and present with what might appear to be psychosis initially, they're often asked, have you seen your traditional doctor? And because of that openness, clinicians, even senior clinicians, are starting to recognize the difference between mental illness and then other types of experience. For instance, there is a condition where in Africa, I don't know if it's in other parts of Africa, but in South Africa, where people have what's called a calling to become a traditional doctor. It's called Mbizo. So they have dreams, they will have hallucinations, and it can appear very much like a psychotic disorder. Obviously, if you see it, and people don't always want to be a traditional healer, so they will, it can be dampened down by a proper traditional healer. But as soon as you present at a hospital, you get given antipsychotic medication, you get dismissed. But more and more, people are starting to recognize how these two presentations are actually different. When someone presents with the calling, with Mbizo, it is quite different from a psychotic disorder. So the patient testimony is being recognized. They've become more credible only because the system's gaps have opened up and people in power are now part of the system that frames this as a legitimate experience in the range of human experience. I think my final thought would be probably for clinicians to think about how we've internalized the injustices that we experience and how we replicate it and perpetuate it and inflict it on others. And the way to extricate ourselves from it is to look at other spaces like literature, poetry, art, and to dialogue with people that have these same experiences and people that are completely different from us. So to really be aware of how we, no matter how open-minded we think we are and no matter how benevolent and caring we think we are, we have internalized this colonial system, this punishing kind of system ourselves.
Thank you. So thank you to all my guests, Thirusha, Ragesh, Rishe. You've all talked so powerfully about what epistemic injustice is and how it relates to health, both at an individual level through to a structural level. So thank you to all of you.